This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Sony Pictures, All Saints, the inspiring true story of Pastor Michael Spurlock, starring John Corbett, All Saints, in theaters now. Rated PG, parental guidance suggested. More information is available at allsaintsmovie.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thank you so much for joining us again. Well, just days ago, Breitbart reported that French police discovered a number of weapons, including a bazooka, in a no-go Paris suburb only a day after young men had robbed officers of their weapons in that same suburb. Police found not only the American-made anti-tank bazooka, which an officer said was likely to have been used in an attack on an armored car, but they also found high-power explosives, among other ammunition and weaponry. And yet, many on the left continue to decry and even laugh off any semblance of the claim that no-go zones actually do exist. Well, my next guest has visited some of these no-go zones, Islamic areas where Sharia law is supported, infidels are not welcome, and law enforcement must beware. Raheem Kassam is the editor-in-chief of Breitbart London, senior distinguished fellow at the Gatestone Institute, and a fellow at the Middle East Forum. His new book is called No-Go Zones, How Sharia Law is Coming to a Neighborhood Near You. And it's a delight to have you, Raheem. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's quite extraordinary, isn't it? These bazookas and all that being found. That was in Saint-Saint-Denis, by the way, which is where the wonderful cathedral is, where all the French kings are buried.
It really is incredible. And I wonder what's more incredible, the fact that this is all going on or the fact that we seem to have not only the left saying there's no such thing really as a no-go zone, but even major media outlets doing puff pieces on some of these no-go zones.
Yeah, absolutely. And when there was the raid of Molenbeek in Brussels just after the Paris attacks, of course, the residents, and actually mostly non-residents of Molenbeek, were sent there with big signs that said, "I heart Molenbeek," and "Isn't this a wonderful multicultural area?" and all that kind of stuff. I mean, even if you were predisposed to say yes to that because you like the cuisine or you like the culture or whatever it is, you also have to address the underlying point, which is these are neighborhoods which are incredibly friendly to terrorists, to harboring criminals, to Sharia law, to radical Islamists. But we never seem to be able to address that point head on. And that's really what the book is about.
Yes, exactly. It's funny because I looked it up and Politico even acknowledges that Molenbeek is home to 51 groups with terror links. And yet I was watching some YouTube videos in preparation for this interview. I saw one from ABC News and they acted like Molenbeek was just the most wonderful little enclave, cute little shops. Nobody was scared. And I thought, how can you have such a disparity between all these news reports of the terrorists that have been linked to Molenbeek and then try to turn around and whitewash the whole thing? What is going on with that?
Well, it flies in the face of the establishment media and the political establishment's fetishization of multiculturalism and this false notion of diversity that they attempt to propagate. I mean, let's be clear. There's nothing diverse about Molenbeek. It is almost unicultural.
Yeah.
And this is just moments away, by the way, from the European Parliament, the European Commission, all the EU's institutions. This is the capital of Europe. And right at the heart of the capital of Europe, you have the terror capital of Europe. Now, the politicians don't want to acknowledge it exists because they might have to get a grip on immigration.
Yes.
They might actually have to start asking questions of the people coming into the country. And they might actually have to start asking questions of the people born in the country that have no affiliations with the nation itself. Well, there are incredible statistics out there that apply as much to America, by the way, as they do to Europe, whereby you will find a huge level of support for the implementation of Sharia law, for the justification of terror attacks, for the forced wearing of the hijab or the burqa in the Western world. And these are usually amongst young Muslim men.
Absolutely. So how would you characterize a no-go zone? I know people can kind of put different definitions on that, but how would you summarize a no-go zone, at least the ones that you have visited?
Well, there are different no-go zones. There are different types of no-go zones. In Sweden, for instance, there are areas that, because criminality is so rife, that the police don't feel comfortable going, or at least don't feel comfortable going in small numbers. Places where the contractors won't actually take the contracts to build new police stations, even though they're desperately needed, because they are fearful of being set upon, robbed, attacks in these areas. So, you know, the governments can't even build new police stations. I've been to areas like this where I've had young women with me at the time as well, helping me out with the research. And they get shouted at, verbally abused, told to cover their heads. There are areas where there is, as we've mentioned already, huge amounts of terror links. And there are areas where, you know, you know, the whole retail profile has changed, the whole culture has changed, to the point where they feel comfortable having pro-Sharia demonstrations out on the streets. I mean, East London, and stress London, the capital of the United Kingdom, has an area just like this, Tower Hamlets, where, yeah, sure, you can walk around in the daytime and probably pop in and out without many problems. But, I mean, I was there just a couple of months ago after I'd completed the book, actually. And as soon as I stepped out of the car, it wasn't just 5 minutes after I stepped out of the car, that I was stopped by this group of young Muslim men who looked at me wearing a sport jacket and nice shoes and said to me, you know, you can't be in this area. You shouldn't be in this area. You don't belong around here. This is my hometown. It's my capital city. And, you know, that's what we're seeing. And by the way, I don't even say it has to be either or extreme response to these places. But the political establishment's response is extreme by putting their fingers in their ears. And all I'm saying is let's have an honest conversation about this place. Let's find some common ground where we can say, yes, look, there are some positives towards for immigration into the West, but all of these negative things point to a real flaw with mass swift migration.
Absolutely. How widespread would you say the problem of no-go zones is in Europe right now, particularly Western Europe?
Well, again, I mean, it depends on how you define a no-go zone. Some of these areas you will find have just incredible high levels of poverty, unemployment, and social deprivation, and they're not, you know, they're not places that you would want to go. They're sort of the Harlem and Bronxes of the 80s. Hmm. They may not have terror links. They may not have radical mosques, but by all means, you wouldn't want to go there. Some of them, as I've mentioned, have far more sinister elements to them, far more sinister things going on there. So, like, people have upper estimates of, you know, there are 750 such areas in Europe. I would err on the conservative side and say there are probably scores of these of the neighborhoods you really need to worry about. But if you take out the ones that are already there and just focus on the sort of milder ones, those milder ones are still targets for the radicals, for the fundamentalists, for the extremists. Because they know that lawlessness is common in these places, and then they don't have anybody to answer to. They don't have anybody breathing down their necks. They don't have the state trying to enforce, you know, what we would assume is basic level common sense, is that when immigrants move into the area, they don't ghettoize, or they're not forced to ghettoize by some of the socialist governments. That's what they're doing in Europe. That their mosques aren't preaching, you know, extreme radical or fundamentalist interpretations of the Quran. And so they've got their eyes on all of these places, and we're doing nothing about it.
No, we're really not. This is interesting because we've seen all this migration into Europe, and we've seen all the boats coming in and the open borders and Angela Merkel and all the rest. And the question for a lot of people is, we have in the United States certainly many, many European immigrants who came here. They retained their ethnicity from back home, but they wanted to assimilate. They wanted to become part of the culture. Why is it that they're not assimilating? I want to get to the United States in the next segment. But in Europe in particular, what is keeping them from assimilating outside of Islam? Or is that the crux of the problem?
Well, I mean, you have to appreciate from the outset that Islam, in its strictest form, is a supremacist ideology.
Yes.
It believes that its manner of thinking, its rule of law, the conditions it places on its adherents are better than the U.S. Constitution, better than the British Parliament, better than anything that Europe can think up. And so as a default setting, that's what these people are being taught to believe, or that they have brought over with them. But interestingly enough, the first generation of migrants that moved into the West from South Asia, the Middle East, North Africa, they actually did want to integrate. They did want to own businesses, pay their taxes, raise their families, even fly the flags of the nations that they had moved into. Especially the second and third generations that are becoming the major problem. One in five young British Muslims, for instance, believes that the 7/7 bombings that happened in 2005 on our tube system can be excused or justified in some way. Mm. Believes that the attack on the Charlie Hebdo offices, this magazine that satirized the Prophet Muhammad, can be justified.
I'll tell you what, hang on just a moment, Raheem. We're going to go to a very quick break. We'll come back with Raheem Kassam talking about his book, No-Go Zones. Stay with us here on Janet Mefford Today.
Here is today's Capitol Hill Brief with Concerned Women for America President Penny Nance.
My heart broke as I read a despicable CBS News clip last week highlighting, almost cheering, that Iceland is, quote, close to eradicating Down syndrome, end quote. You and I would cheer too had they found a cure. But the total opposite is true. Iceland is not eradicating Down syndrome. As the horrid report says, they're exterminating Down syndrome babies through abortion. This report exposes the shocking view and utilitarian philosophy towards people with disabilities in this country. We can do better, and the church must stand up for the least of these. Please join Concerned Women for America to pray against this warped mindset.
Join the fight to defend the unborn and give them the right to live. Every life matters, and we want to see laws passed that uphold these values. Visit CapitolHillBrief.org to fund the fight today. That's CapitolHillBrief.org. Everyone loves liberty. Our rights come from God, not from government. So why are you letting other people tell you what's best for your health care? Exercise your freedom with Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of people who voluntarily share one another's medical costs. Liberty HealthShare is founded on the idea that most people truly want to help one another. Healthcare sharing allows members to do just that as a true community that supports one another in times of need. Liberty believes people should make decisions for themselves and their families. Members are able to take back the freedom to make their own decisions about their healthcare. Freedom from guilt or doubt about how your money is used. You have the freedom to direct your healthcare, not to be dictated to by bureaucrats. Stop letting others tell you what to do and join a community of like-minded people. Exercise your freedom. Join Liberty HealthShare and take back the control of your healthcare while helping those around you. Call us at 855-58-LIBERTY for more information or check us out online at libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org. This hour of Janet Mefford Today is brought to you in part by Sony Pictures, All Saints. The inspiring true story of Pastor Michael Spurlock, starring John Corbett, All Saints, in theaters now. Rated PG, parental guidance suggested. More information is available at allsaintsmovie.com. We're back on Janet Mefford Today. Thank you so much for joining us. And it's great to have with us Raheem Kassam, editor-in-chief of Breitbart London and author of No-Go Zones, How Sharia Law is Coming to a Neighborhood Near You. You cited some statistics before we went to the break, Raheem, which I think are extremely significant. One in five British Muslims justified the 7/7 attacks and also the Charlie Hebdo, what happened in France. This is what really frightens people when you see especially the Islamic State saying, well, we want to inspire people all across the globe to attack their countries from within. This is what is really becoming a huge problem in Europe, but also a problem in the United States, and maybe hasn't come to full fruition yet. But this is all tied to the no-go zones, that we certainly can't have non-assimilating areas where terror can thrive.
Right. And again, let's stress that it's specifically the second and third generations for whom this is happening. I mean, it was actually 31% of younger British Muslims that were polled by the Pew research company that said that the 7/7 bombings can be either endorsed or excused. Wow. But only 14% of those over 45 had the same view.
Yes.
I'm just looking at the figures in front of me here now, because as you say, they're actually very startling. Suicide bombings are justified. This is 26% of young Muslims in America believe that. 35% in Britain, 42% in France, 22% in Germany, 29% in Spain. And so, you know, when we talk about these issues, and the standard line that is thrown back at us is, oh, yes, but it's not all Muslims. Yeah, but it's a significant proportion of them, and right. It's only actually getting worse. And that's what we're trying to convey here. I mean, the levels of criminality in these communities is extraordinary as well. There's been a rise of a 23% rise of the number of prisoners that are Muslim in Britain's top security jails in the past 5 years. And it's completely disproportionate to the actual number in terms of, you know, population. You look at the statistics in terms of anti-Semitism in Western Europe, an average 55% of Muslims harbor anti-Semitic attitudes. That was a poll done by the Anti-Defamation League in 2015. And this is happening here in the United States, too. It's such a growing problem. And nobody wants to see, you know, the average person, you know, who might be running your corner store, who might be driving a cab, who might be a local business owner, persecuted for their religion. You know, your country is founded on the freedom of religion. But when it moves into this area where they can start using their faith to justify the murder, assassination, rape, torture, genital mutilation of other people, well, then you'd think, you really would think, that the human rights lobby would swing into effect here, and we're just not seeing it. You can march 400,000 people down the street, down the National Mall, when a new president is elected, but you can't even get 400 people out to Livonia in Michigan when young girls are having their genitals mutilated in the name of culture or religion.
Exactly. Well, people are afraid. They're always afraid. They're afraid of being called Islamophobes and bigots and racist. Don't you think that those sorts of tools, the Orwellian tools of don't say anything, are intimidating people into not speaking out on issues where if another group was committing the same sorts of atrocities, they would speak out freely?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think so. I know so. There is documentary evidence now that exists across the Western world, including in the United States, that shows that terror attacks could have been foiled if somebody had said something.
Yeah.
If somebody had said something, but they didn't say anything because they were fearful that they would be branded an Islamophobe. Now, I don't care about being branded an Islamophobe, and I was branded the Islamophobe of the Year in 2014 by the Iranian Human Rights Commission, which, as I always say, is a group with a name as oxymoronic as the Senate Intelligence Committee. but this is what people are fearful of. And by the way, it's not just people like me who are former Muslims. It's not just people like you who are non-Muslims. It's actually Muslims themselves who are fearful of what happens if they say something about their child or their cousin or somebody in their neighborhood. They get set upon in much the same way. And they don't just get set upon, by the way, by other Muslims. They get set upon by the political left.
Yes.
When you look at the Southern Poverty Law Center in the United States of America, this group that, you know, CNN uses as a source on hate groups around America, the Southern Poverty Law Center actually calls practicing Muslims who simply don't want to adhere to Sharia law, they call them, you know, Islamophobes and bigots and haters and xenophobes.
Right.
Dr. Zudi Jasser, who is a popular reformist in operating out of Arizona, Majid Nawaz in the United Kingdom. You have a situation where there's a Canadian author called Raheel Raza operating out of Canada.
Yeah.
And they're actually attacked by the political left in tandem with these hardline Muslim clerics. And told to shut up or they'll, you know, well, or else, basically.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's crazy. Now, in America, one of the things that you say that I think will alarm people, but I think you're right about this, is you talk about some of these places in America where we do have these essentially Muslim ghettos where radicals are establishing a momentum that will transform America into Europe in the next 20 years if this momentum is not stopped. We hear about places like Dearborn. We hear about places like Hamtramck, some of these places in Michigan. And I think a lot of people look at that and say, well, it's just Michigan. You know, who cares about Michigan? What is the big picture in America, though, when it comes to no-go zones?
Well, the big picture is that, you know, they're not just targeting Michigan. They're targeting wherever they can. You see, the reason Michigan was so easy was because property was cheap and it was cheap to live there. And therefore, it was just far easier to immigrate there, buy up big plots of land, build mosques, so on and so forth. But I saw the same, you know, factors starting up in Brooklyn, for instance, in Queens as well. I've seen it taking place all across America. You have places called Islamburg and Islamville today in 2017 in the United States of America.
Right.
These private compounds that are being bought up en masse, where we know from leaked information, leaked video from the inside of these compounds that there's guerrilla warfare training. The FBI has raided some of these places in the past, found huge weapons caches. These guys are cults. Cultish in their mentality. and they only adhere to Sharia and by what their faith leaders tell them to do, they usually run out of Pakistan or India or something like that. I mean, there's this one group called Jamaat al-Fukra, which is basically run by this crazed old man called Sheikh Jilani, who dictates to these people in America what to do while he's sitting pretty in Pakistan. And I speak to law enforcement in this country, and they say, look, we know this is going on, but our resources are so stretched because they're dealing with things like Salafism and Wahhabism, you know, the Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State threat,
yes,
that they don't actually focus on the real world threat, which manifest themselves in attacks like the attack in San Bernardino, where these two people, Tashfeen Malik and Syed Farooq, you talk to anybody that knew them, said, oh, yeah, we were all friends. They didn't exhibit anything strange. But I'll tell you what was strange. We've sort of normalized this idea that you can have these radical mosques in the United States. It should have been strange to people that they were even going to one of these mosques, that one of these mosques even existed in their country. 74% of mosques in Britain now are run by this same group, this extremist group. We refer to them in the United Kingdom as the Army of Darkness, because they are so shady and they're so smart and quiet in the way they do things. You know, they're not like the Anjum Chowdhury types of the world who people might have seen on the Sean Hannity show, or
yes,
you know, these radical clerics who you see mouthing off sometimes. They actually do things very quietly. They don't attract attention, and it really is incumbent on your national government and your local law enforcement to work together to root these things out.
Well, it is. We can't even get the Muslim Brotherhood designated a terrorist organization thus far, though. It's very frustrating.
Yeah, it's absolutely dreadful. I mean, this should have been one of the first things this president has done, and I really implore him to do so. This is a group that wishes nothing but harm on the United States of America. It's very clear in the way they operate. You know, it's not just the Muslim Brotherhood, but it's the prime example of how, especially with the last administration, with the Obama administration, they didn't try and make things harder for them. In a lot of ways, they actually made things easier for them to recruit, to have their message put out. I mean, what Barack Obama said when he was president at that Cairo speech, when he quoted from the Quran, that was a Muslim Brotherhood talking point. I mean, almost literally, that could have come off the photocopier in a Muslim Brotherhood office. And you know, if you want me to elaborate on that, I can.
Yeah, go ahead.
So he gives the line. He stands up there and he uses the line that the Muslim Brotherhood groups and the affiliates in the United States and all across Europe always give when there's a terror attack. It's section 5, paragraph 32 of the Quran. He who takes a life takes the life of all mankind. He who saves a life of all mankind. That is what Obama said in Cairo as he went there prostrate before the Muslim world, begging for forgiveness for all America's ills. He forgot to read the very next line out, because that sounds good. That sounds like a repudiation of terrorism and of murder. But he forgot to read the next line out. And the next line is best summarized like this. But if you try and stand in the way of the movement of Islam, then you should have your left hand cut off and your right foot cut off. That is literally the very next line in the Quran. But of course, Obama stops at a convenient period.
And you talk about, you interview, and I'm really glad that you did, Philip Haney, who wrote See Something, Do Nothing. And he talked about how, you know, he was thwarted at the Department of Homeland Security and he was not able to, you know, put together the dots on Tabligi Jamaat, which would have had an impact on the San Bernardino attacks had he been able to do that. This is what we're talking about now. And so what do you suggest needs to be done in order to thwart the momentum of these no-go zones?
Well, firstly, you know, just like the president is always saying, You want to put the control of military strategy back in the people who have to deal with the situations on the ground. This administration needs to take the same approach to tackling terrorism at home as it wants to abroad. You have to put the control back in the officers, the people like Philip Haney, who were seeing people coming in and out of the country where they were going to, you know, were having conversations with them at the airports, were interviewing them, were figuring out, connecting all these dots together. What the Obama administration did is it removed all local level power. It removed power from people who are stationed at the USA's entry and exit points, and it put the power in control of the federal government. It put all the power in Washington, D.C. This is the Washington, D.C. mindset. It's the swamp mindset, if I can use that term. They just want to focus in on themselves and their buddies. They don't care what's going on in your communities.
I'll tell you what, we've got to do something and pick up no-go zones. Raheem Kassam from Breitbart London. Such a joy to talk to you, Raheem. Thank you for your great work.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
All right. Take care. We'll be back. This Janet Meffer Today podcast is sponsored by Sony Pictures, All Saints, the inspiring true story of Pastor Michael Spurlock, starring John Corbett, All Saints, in theaters now. Rated PG, parental guidance suggested. More information is available at allsaintsmovie.com. We're back on Janet Meffer Today. We all know the wonderful words of Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. But when we get down to the science of creation and the evidence of the Creator, how much more can we declare the glory of God and rejoice in his handiwork? Well, my next guest knows all about it. Dr. David Bradstreet is professor and chair of the Astronomy and Physics Department at Eastern University and director of the David H. Bradstreet Observatory and Julia Fowler Planetarium. And as we are able more than ever to explore the vastness of space, he says we can understand more about the character of our Creator, and we're just really excited to have him here to talk about his new book. It is called Starstruck, Seeing the Creator in the Wonders of Our Cosmos. And it's wonderful to have you, Dr. Bradstreet. How are you?
Thank you, Janet. I'm doing very well. Great to be with you.
Thank you. It's great to have you here. You know, there are a lot of people, as you well know, who say you can't be a scientist or be a PhD in a scientific area and also be a Christian, that this is just incompatible. What do you respond to people who think that way?
Well, that's certainly not what the early astronomers during the Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo time felt at all. They were very devout Christians, very serious about their faith, and they were very serious that the things they were discovering were actually bringing them closer to God, not doing away with the need for God.
That's right. Well, you talk in the book about how you were just a child when you became interested in astronomy, and I think that's so fascinating. What was it that drew you up to the stars?
Well, it's a good question. My brother had a golden book of astronomy. It had lots of nice pictures in it. I used to thumb through that book every once in a while, and I said to myself, you know, you enjoy this book so much, why don't you do this for a living? And so when I was 8 years old, that's what I decided I would do. I've always had a fascination for the heavens and what's in them. And, you know, I'm a science fiction nerd, and so it all goes along together.
Yeah. Didn't you have a sighting of Venus early on as a kid?
Yes. That notebook page is in the book reproduced. It's really quite funny. In fact, one of my astronomer friends said that was the favorite part of the book for him.
Yeah, it is really neat. Well, this is interesting. What have been some of the marvels of astronomy, would you say, that have shored up your faith as a Christian? For example, you talk about binary stars, but there are many, many instances, obviously. But what about astronomy really has embedded for you the truth that, of course, there's a Creator?
Well, when you start learning about the details of what's going on in the heavens, when you start looking at stars, what they really are, and the fact that as they age and they go through these processes and they turn from one star to another, you see that the universe looks like a beautiful tapestry which God has been graceful enough to give us brains to start to both understand but share in the glory of it. It really is fantastic. The more you learn, the more excited you get.
Yeah. Well, you know, for many of us laymen here who aren't scientists, we look up at the stars and we say, oh, that's pretty. And maybe that's the Little Dipper. I'm not really sure. But what do we really need to understand about stars? Share with us some of the details about the complexities of stars. I know you could go on for a while about that. But what do you think really would grab our attention about stars if we knew it?
I think that If we just even knew a few of the details about the sun, but stars, you know, they can't last forever. They're gaining their energy from nuclear fusion. And so they can last a long time, but eventually they start running out of fuel. And when they run out of fuel, they start to get a little wacky, like people getting older. And
yes.
So our sun eventually will run out of fuel and start expanding and turning into a red giant, which will eventually encompass the Earth, and that'll be the end of us. But it's not next Tuesday. It's probably 5 billion years from now, so I wouldn't lose any sleep over it like my 5-year-old did years ago.
Oh, that's good to know. That's good to know. How complex are stars? I mean, I know that they're different. The sun obviously is a unique sort of star. But when you just talk about the rank and file star that we'd see up in the sky if we're lying in the grass on a summer night, what about those stars is amazing?
Well, for me, just the fact that they exist is pretty amazing. But that it's really kind of an interesting question. Our bodies are far more complex than stars.
Hmm.
If you talk to an astrophysicist, he'll tell you, yes, stars are complex, but they can be described by a finite number of equations, you know, so that you can make computer models. And yes, they're not simple, but they're not nearly as complex as the human body.
Right.
So they're complex in a way, but they're not as complex as you might think.
That is fascinating.
They obey certain physical laws, and those laws are finite in number.
Do we know the number, or at least the ballpark number of stars in our solar system?
Well, sure. You answered it yourself. In the solar system, that's one star.
Yeah, one star.
So,
wow.
So what you were thinking of was the Milky Way.
Oh, the Milky Way. There you go.
Right. So the Milky Way is our island galaxy, and you're talking about 200 to 300 billion stars in our galaxy.
That's amazing. That's just incredible.
Yeah, and what's worse than that is the fact that our Milky Way is one galaxy out of probably 100 billion others.
I can't even comprehend.
Which have hundreds of billions of stars. So it's an interesting point, and I make this very clear to my students that God told us this a long time ago, but we weren't smart enough to realize it. Are you interested in that story?
I am, very much.
When God told Abraham, before he was Abraham, he was Abram, and he promised to give him descendants as numerous as the stars, That's not much of a statement back 4,000 years ago.
Right.
Because you can only see 6,000 stars.
Right.
But we've since discovered that they're far more than that. And he said that to Abraham after he was trying to sacrifice his son Isaac.
Yes.
And he said, I'll make your descendants as numerous as the stars. And then he added something. He said, and as numerous as the sand on the seashores.
That's right.
Goodness. We found out now that there actually are that many stars. In fact, there's about 10,000 stars in the universe for every grain of sand on the seashores.
Oh, boy. That is so interesting.
You know, and that we didn't know that until 1930.
So the Bible was ahead of the game when it came
way
to the scientists.
Way ahead of the game. And no human being would have written that in Scripture because no one ever dreamed that there were that many stars in the universe.
That's cool. That is really cool. Now, when you talk about the adjustment of the Earth on many scores, that God has adjusted everything perfectly so the Earth can maintain what it is and also sustain life, what have been the most amazing things to you about how the Earth is constructed in a very, you know, intentionally designed way that allow it to operate the way it does?
Well, the most obvious one is the tilt of the planet. What that does is moderate our climate. If you think of the Earth with no tilt, so the sun would be beating down on the equator all the time, The equatorial regions would be so hot that it would be very difficult to have life there. And then the poles would be just the opposite, extremely cold. And at the intersection, you'd have hurricanes all the time. But the tilt makes the sunlight direct on the Earth in certain places at certain times. And that has a moderating factor. That's number one. Number two, a much less well-known fact, is our moon helps to keep the Earth at that 23.5 degree tilt.
Oh, interesting.
And so if we didn't have a moon steadying us, then the Earth would actually change its inclination through time, much like Mars does. I mean, it takes millions of years, but you don't want the Earth changing its inclination because that's going to make your climate a mess.
Well, that's interesting. People think about the moon in relationship to the tide, for example.
Yes.
But how does the moon actually affect the tilt of the Earth?
It helps keep it steady. Let me put it that way. It's a steadying gravitational influence which helps keep it at that particular angle.
That's neat. I had never heard that before. So the tilt that we're at, how much more could it tilt and continue to sustain life on the planet?
That's a good question. Probably, it could probably tilt a couple degrees either way. But it, of course, no matter what you do, it's going to affect the climate.
Yes.
So you don't want to change it more than a couple degrees, or you're going to start getting either, you know, too extreme, or it's going to oscillate between extremes.
Right. And you think about what would be the chances that, you know, according to the naturalist perspective, that we could just, you know, naturally by chance, by random selection, you know, the Earth is at the exact tilt it needs to be in order to sustain life.
Yeah, I see. And I don't buy that myself. I mean, you can't prove that God did it. But it seems to me it's kind of evident that he has.
I agree.
And it isn't just the tilt. I mean, there's a myriad of things in nature that would attest to, gee, this looks like it was planned out.
It sure does. We're going to come back on Janet Mefford Today. Dr. David Bradstreet, his book, Starstruck, Seeing the Creator in the Wonders of Our Cosmos. We'll be back.
In these ever-changing, increasingly turbulent times, I believe God is calling you to be set apart. But what does that mean in practical, everyday terms? This is Jeannie Niger with Unshaken. Being set apart in these times means no more giving the enemy ground in your life. God wants to free you from the lies you believe about yourself and about Him. He wants to carry your burdens so that you have nothing else to focus on but Him. He wants to deliver you from your fears, stress, hurts, insecurities, perfectionism, bitterness, anything that blocks intimacy with Him and gives the enemy ground in your life. God is raising up an army of those who are set apart for Him and His purposes. Are you in? For more on how to remain unshaken in a world that's all shook up, or to download a free chapter of my book, Unshaken, Standing Strong in Uncertain Times, go to jeannienigro.com/Janet. That's JeannieNigro.com/Janet.
From Affirm Films and Provident Films, who brought you War Room, comes All Saints. New pastor Michael Spurlock, his struggling congregation, and a group of refugees come together, trusting God as they plant seeds for a future that might just save them all.
Start a farm, we work together, we save the church.
All Saints, starring John Corbett. Now playing. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested. More information is available at allsaintsmovie.com.
Hi, this is Janet Mefford, and on behalf of Janet Mefford Today and the Ministry Preborn, we'd like to thank you for helping us reach our goal of giving 300 babies a chance to live, but the need is still great. Nearly 1 in 4 pregnancies end in abortion, and there are more moms to reach and more children to save. So if you haven't had a chance to donate, there's still time left. You can sponsor 5 free ultrasounds for just $140. Simply call 855-601-BABY. 100% of your gift goes toward saving babies, and all gifts are tax deductible. That's 855-601-2229. As we said with Dr. David Bradstreet, who is joining us, professor and chair of the Astronomy and Physics Department at Eastern University and also author of Starstruck, Seeing the Creator in the Wonders of Our Cosmos. It is incredible to consider all of the things that are evident in creation when we look around, especially up in the heavens. But it's also interesting to note that the Bible had it right long before a lot of us here on Earth did. Now, you talk in the book, Dr. Bradstreet, about how our ancient ancestors tended to view the world. And of course, we've come a long way scientifically, but what do you gather from that, you know, the ancient perspective on making sense of the universe?
That's such a good question. I think that, and I wouldn't say necessarily ancient, but if you talk about Galileo and Kepler and you know, these people in the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, when they looking at nature and studying nature, they considered that to be a form of worship. That God had presented to them a book of revelation, which we call the Bible, but that creation they looked at, this book of nature, was also something to be studied and understood. And as Kepler said, as you understand it, you're really thinking God's thoughts after Him. That's what he said in a letter.
Right.
And I really feel that that's important, that the idea of, you know, scientists, they're missing it today. They think that when we discover these equations, these what we call laws, that the universe obeys these laws because the universe obeys the laws.
Yes.
And rather, I think a different way of looking at this is that what we're doing is discovering how God does what he does. This idea that God made the universe, and now he's in the Bahamas reading a newspaper, and it just runs merrily along without any intervention from him. It's not intervention. It's a continual sustaining.
Right.
And what we measure as God at work is what we call physical laws.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
It's really important. The difference, when we say in church, God the Creator, you hear that all the time. We really need to say just as often, God Creator and sustainer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's great.
I can't emphasize that enough, so that the table that you're sitting at or the chair you're sitting in is being held together secular scientists would say by electrical laws. I would say that's true, but those electrical laws are doing that because God is commanding them to do that.
Amen. That's neat. Why, that's interesting, too, because when you study the heavens, what do the heavens reveal to us about God's sustaining presence? You've got a chapter on that in the book.
Well, this is it. I mean, God is continually at work, as Jesus said, that, you know, my Father's continually at work as I am continually at work. That, yes, God created the universe, but now it's being upheld by his word continually.
Yes.
And people say, well, how can God be controlling every single electron and every atom throughout the universe? That's crazy. And it's like, is your God infinite or not?
Right, right.
That he could be in control of an infinite number of particles in an infinite number of universes and still have time to sit with you and give you a hug. there's no draining God's capability. And we've got to have a bigger God.
Yeah. Your God is too small, as
exactly
the book said.
Right.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, going back to what you said about the moon, for example, we were chatting before the break about how the moon actually affects the tilt of the earth. And we know the moon also affects the tide. But you also talk about the sun. And, as you mentioned, the sun, we are a solar powered earth for sure.
Yes.
What should we know about the sun that perhaps the average Christian has never stopped to consider?
Almost all energy in almost every form originates in the sun.
Hmm.
Right? If you're eating vegetables, you know, just ask yourself, so where did that lettuce come from? You know, it's a green plant, it's absorbing sunlight.
Yes.
The wind, you know, weather, it's all solar powered. Everything really comes from, the only thing that isn't coming from the sun is geothermal.
Hmm.
You know, like volcanoes and plate tectonics and
yes.
That kind of stuff.
Right.
Everything else comes, so the sun is our source of energy. And that there's a lot of spiritual analogies you could draw from that, but, it's the sun is, without the sun, we'd be nothing. Not only have nothing to orbit, we'd have basically no energy.
No, right, we'd all be dead. What about the glory of God underground? I know this is going the other direction, but it's something that you talk about in the book as well, and you just alluded to when you think
yes.
about geothermal power in Yellowstone, where you see the bubbling up of
yes.
all the rest. But what about God's glory under the earth?
Well, it's really interesting. If you look at, when you were little and you looked at a map of the world and you looked at the east coast of South America,
mm-hmm.
and the west coast of Africa, you immediately are struck by, gee, it looks like two puzzle pieces that would fit together. And the reason it looks that way is because they used to be together.
Right.
And so the earth is continually changing and reforming. And like if you go to Hawaii, you can watch the molten lava come out. And basically it's continuing to make the big island. And the Hawaiian Islands are a chain, all of which have passed over that hot spot. That's why it's a chain going to the northwest, because the Pacific Plate is being taken over this hot spot, creating island after island after island. And once the island is off the hot spot, then all the volcanoes go dormant, and a new island is formed.
Oh, wow.
And you can see that if you look at what are called the Emperor Seamounts. This has been going on a long time, because there's a chain of underground mountains that goes across the whole way up across the Pacific and then up towards the Bering Strait.
Mm.
And so it's not like, gee, the Earth looks like this and it's always looked like this. The Earth used to be very different.
Yeah.
And so God is continually changing the surface of the earth, and that's cool.
It is so cool. Oh, Grand Canyon. Anybody who's ever been to the Grand Canyon and thinks about the Colorado River forming that whole thing, it's just extraordinary.
That really is remarkable.
It surely is. What about discoveries that are on the horizon, Dr. Bradstreet? Because, you know, scientists are discovering new things all the time. We're able to see further out
time.
In space all the time and find new things. But what have, you know, we still have to, what do we still have to discover? What's still out there? I know the fact that we haven't discovered it means we don't know it's there yet, but
right.
What are some of the things on the horizon?
Yeah, so the Juno satellite just reached Jupiter, and that's going to give us new close-up pictures of Jupiter, which will be spectacular.
Mm.
And Jupiter is a planet that, when it formed, it pretty much stayed the way it was when it formed, and so it's good to study Jupiter. That shows us what many of the planets would have looked like when they first formed. So that's exciting.
Mm-hmm.
There's a satellite called the Gaia satellite, which has been taking distance measurements to literally billions of stars. And that's going to increase our understanding of them many, many fold. Because if we don't know the distance to a star, that limits our ability to truly understand them.
Yeah.
And then in several years, a replacement for the Hubble telescope is going up, the James Webb Space Telescope, which is 7 times larger across than the Hubble.
Oh, my.
So that's going to extend our knowledge of the creation of the universe, because we'll be able to see further out into space with higher precision. And so I suspect that as much as the Hubble has changed our view of things, the new James Webb telescope will do the same. So it's a very exciting time astronomically to be alive.
Oh, yeah. Well, when you think about the Hubble telescope, how powerful that is already, and you think about what has been spotted and what has been discovered and new things on the horizon all the time, do you find that those new discoveries really make you feel more humble? You know, in other words, there are some scientists who would say, oh, well, you know, a little bit arrogant in what they know, and we know science this and science that. But really, as you discover more, shouldn't it do the opposite to you?
Yes, exactly. Does not true knowledge simply reveal how little you really know?
Yeah, right.
You know, and this is what Socrates said so long ago. He considered himself to be the stupidest person in Athens, when in reality he was the smartest, but he knew what he didn't know.
That's it.
And so, you know, the Bible warns us that knowledge puffs up, and, you know, knowledge of God will make you more humble.
And yes.
God wants us to be humble, not because he wants us humble to be humble, but he wants us to be humble so we understand our true state.
That's it. That's it.
So,
that's great.
And when we understand those things, then we're in a much better position to be happy and be God-like.
Oh, it's neat. How do you think Christians can learn to appreciate God's creation more thoroughly?
I think that they should not be afraid of science.
Good.
In other words, the more we learn about God's creation, it's not going to push him into a box where we only need him to explain miracles. See, it's just this God of the gaps mentality. We've got to get rid of it.
Yeah, we sure do.
You need God to explain everything.
Oh, man. Well, that is wonderful, and a wonderful book, Starstruck, Seeing the Creator and the Wonders of Our Cosmos. Dr. David Bradstreet with us today, and such a great thing that you were able to be with us today, Dr. Bradstreet. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're so welcome. It was a great pleasure for me, Janet.
Oh,
thank you.
God bless you. Thanks for being with us. And thank you, too, for joining us here on Janet Mefford today. We appreciate you tuning in. God bless you. Have a great day.